Welcome to the Mike and Doug Show. I'm Doug. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Doug.
Well, I'm excited today because in all the time that I've known you, you've never used the two magic words, patent pool. And now you've laid out a history of patent pools and demonstrated that what happened to, of course, the lead story at Americans of Innovation, which is Leader Technologies' theft of their invention by, you know, literally government agents, as it were, you know, this is the next step. This is showing that Leader Technology was kind of a reverse patent pool, but it shows that patent pools go back to the beginning when corporatists decided that they were going to have monopolies concerning all patents. So I'm very excited because your recent article, which I have now read twice, because it is so amazingly comprehensive. And I just want to say that it is almost an inner language that is being used by you and the miners to describe a history that has been well hidden, but it's been in front of us all the time. For instance, in your recent article, you mentioned, Victor Rothschild, Jacob Rothschild, Lionel Rothschild, N.M. Rothschild, Nathan Rothschild. So all the Rothschilds are pointed out not as a conspiracy finger-pointing, but as reality history mixed in with the other people who were just as corrupt with as they were in stealing patents from the time of Marconi and the wireless, I would call it a cabal or a syndicate, which it's literally called, and you're going to have to explain this to us today, a patent pool. What does that mean and how they could even exist? It seems to me they should be illegal to begin with. But these patent pools go back to the British. They've been the experts at it. They've controlled wireless, then they control communication, which is all communication and all news networks, and then intelligence, and then spying, and on there have been patent pools that have been legal that shouldn't have been, in my opinion, because they not only promoted monopolies and antitrust violations, but they basically are just the worst type of theft. And it just highlights what Leader Technologies had gone through. So your article, by the way, that you've done with your with the lead writers over there at Americans of Innovation, brilliant article. I thought the one before that, where you had tunneled down with your miners into Virginia and come up in Glenn Youngkin's bedroom and found out that Glenn was not only the previous CEO of the horriblest cabal, the militaristic cabal of Carlyle Group, but also was a principal mover and doer at Kinetic. Again, all British alignment. So now Virginia is under the control of someone who's given their complete allegiance to the Queen.
Correct.
How does that happen? And from there, then all of a sudden you pop up with your new article that just absolutely floors the myself and the conclave who've been discussing it, these patent pools. These are obviously the biggest controllers of theft, because when it comes down to it, inventions are the greatest wealth there is. So the biggest control and of theft that is literally institutionalized and completely controlled by the British. So thank you for your article, and please thank
You're
the
welcome.
Writers, thank the staff writers, and tell them that the conclave over here, that you really stumped us on this one.
Yes, I think the whole team as well. And, you know, this subject came up because someone called us and said, well, did you know that Judge Leonard P. Stark has been nominated by Biden to be the next federal circuit judge? And I did not know. And as it turns out, that announcement is only about a month old. And of course, we all knew a lot about Leonard P. Stark because our trial was his first court case as a presiding judge. Even though he was a magistrate on our case, he was shoehorned in at the last minute. 2 weeks before trial, the veteran judge of 23 years, Joseph J. Farnan, magically decided that he was going to retire a little early, even though he told us he was going to retire after the case. He decides to retire 2 weeks before the case. Now, coincidentally, a few months earlier, Facebook had lost a devastating Markman hearing. And in a Markman hearing, that's where both sides get together with the judge and they decide what, how with the terms of the new patent, assuming that it's an innovation and therefore there weren't words for it before the patent was issued, how do we use words in this trial that are going to be consistent with the definitions within the patent? And that's a very critical hearing. A lot of cases get settled after a Markman hearing simply because one side or the other loses the argument. And in this case, Facebook fell flat on its face. And so we were pretty encouraged by that. And then all of a sudden, we did not know, but Obama nominated Stark, who was a magistrate in our case, all of a sudden to be the next Delaware district court judge. And then we began to see a lot of games being played in the system itself, which we now know involved Obama, Eric Holder, Hillary Clinton. And we also discovered that that was about the time that the Obama administration started cutting deals privately through Hillary Clinton with Facebook to build, specifically to build a patent for winning elections, not a patent, but build technology to win elections using the Facebook platform. So all this was going on behind the scenes, and Zuckerberg was sitting there stonewalling any provision of his source code from the software that he claims to have invented in 2003, 2004. And magically, we never got any of it. And 2 weeks before trial, Leonard Stark allowed Facebook to flip their claims against us 180 degrees. So their argument all the way through the patent litigation preparation was that we had nothing innovative and Leader was just smoke and dope. And then they lost the Markman hearing. And therefore, the next thing we know, 2 weeks before trial, they flipped the argument around to say, okay, Leader has something innovative, but they tried to sell it too soon. And so they come up with a whole new cockamamie argument. And then when that happens in court, your due process rights are, the other side gets time to prepare the new defenses for what they've alleged. This is a counterclaim. And but Stark decides that we don't need any additional discovery, that we already have all the information. And that's not even his opinion. That's not even his right to decide. If somebody changes their claims dramatically, the other side gets a right to prepare those defenses. That didn't happen in our case. We had to go to trial 2 weeks later without any defenses for this new claim. And to cut a long story short, we got a split verdict. We proved on 11 of 11 claims that Facebook is infringing our patent. And then we watched the magic occur. We watched the district court agree that Leader tried to sell it too soon, even though there was no evidence. And even if it's possible, there are two big cases that are well tested that the side alleging the early on sale bar must prove. They must submit source code that proves that we showed this source code to somebody too early and tried to sell it too early. And they never did that. This is the PAF decision and also the Group One decision. Anybody in patent litigation knows those cases well, because as it turns out, we've now looked at the history of the PAF case and we're the outlier. We're the only time that on sale bar was ever used as an argument, and yet the party against whom that was being asserted was not allowed to gather evidence, nor were they allowed to,
probably prepare the case.
It was prepare the case. And there was another key aspect of that. Oh, the other side has to prove with hard evidence, not just hearsay, that that this alleged on sale bar occurred. It never occurred. It was a smoke and mirrors case. And yet Stark supported it.
Well, you got Judge Leonard Stark being appointed to an appeals court Federal that controls most of the patent questions.
And his daddy, all patent appeals.
All patent appeals. Okay. And his daddy, Walter, basically was the director of one of these patent pools for Hazeltine, which basically every single radio needed to have this component put in it that Hazeltine controlled. So they created a patent pool. And so basically Leonard, the judge, gets to watch his daddy do this in real life. And it can basically it affects the whole world.
Right.
And then later he basically becomes that. He becomes a patent pool sitting on the bench himself.
Exactly.
This was the most ridiculous thing imaginable. How did they not? You pointed out it's fraud because they did not disclose the fact that this has been their family business.
Correct. Okay. That was not at all known to the Senate. He's never disclosed the name of his father in any biography. And had we known his background, which was deep in telecommunications and collaboration and wireless technology, we would have obviously opposed him being assigned to the case because of his family background. He hid that. He has never disclosed that anywhere. And so it took our researchers about a week to finally crack the code on that. And again, as usual for researchers, obituaries are very useful because it's one of those times in a person's life when their family is halfway honest about their loved one who's just died. Another time is when they want to be a judge. And so they put a lot of that information to the Supreme Court in their confirmation hearing. But even that, he said nothing about his father's associations in his Supreme Court, his Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing. And that alone is fraud. And so he didn't disclose that to us. So therefore, when a judge commits fraud on his own court, that judgment that he has made has to be unwound. That's just the law. And yet, there he is, waiting to be ascended or enthroned at the Federal Circuit.
Now, our listeners, our subscribers, realize that we oftentimes incline towards pointing out the British corruption. And in this, there's British corruption. And also the fact that it leads back to the theft of Leader Technologies inventions. Why? This, what it demonstrates over and over and over and over and over and over and over again is anytime you deal with anything with patents, the British are involved.
Right.
Secondly, anytime you deal with anything that is national security, they have complete control over it. So DARPA, Highlands Forum, NQTEL, they're all involved. And so then someone might say, well, as I just pointed out, there was a patent pool for intelligence. Well, who was in charge of that? General Freeze. Who was on your board?
Correct.
General Freeze. Who? So the people who are also representing Hillary Clinton in her type of patent theft that she started down Little Rock, Arkansas with the QRS-11 and then on and on and on and on to this very day, to the very crypto keys that are used on the internet. She has control of the majority of them. How does that happen? Because Professor Chandler was one of the top lawyers telling people, literally writing laws that were then passed on to legislators to pass so that the corruption could become institutionalized. So when we're talking about the theft of social media, you're talking about one of the largest thefts in modern history or in all times because of the amount of money we're talking about, trillions of dollars. And then it would actually then become not only just Facebook, it would become everyone who ever used it. It's a reverse patent pool where you get to say to all of them, okay, now you can go on now that it's been proven that Facebook stole it from us, but so did IBM Eclipse Foundation. And they basically, everyone who took it as supposedly open source technology needs to now pay to have it the right to be able to use the technology of the original inventors.
Well, let's be real clear about what we proved. What we proved means that anyone using Facebook or enjoying Facebook is probably an unwitting co-conspirator with Facebook certainly is using stolen property. And when you think of it in that way, the whole of this social media technology comes into play. And that's how we got to this investigation of Stark. Now, you mentioned the patent pool that his daddy, Walter, was essentially in charge of. But let's go into a little bit more detail, because it is much more nefarious than one could ever imagine. If we go back to the one of the things we have to realize is that when telephony, radio telegraphy came into commercial use, the propaganda systems in London were using that on a daily basis to basically push out over the entire world at, in late 1800s, or certainly by 1900, consistent messages that the British Empire wanted to pitch all over the world. And what we have to realize is that specifically the people in charge of this within the British Empire are essentially the governors of the Bank of England. And when we started looking at the details of their backgrounds, what we realized is these banker attorneys, they were all attorneys. And in the post that's been prepared, we actually show the director and governor's ledger for the Bank of England, primary archive information, to prove that all of the people involved with banking in the British Empire are attorneys. And so there we see a consistency of a golden thread, if you like, of this corruption that the British have been pressing. And now we are looking back even earlier into two or three centuries earlier. They decided that they were going to steal inventions because they realized that that was the economic value that they could then exploit. And they've never stopped doing that. So by the time the War of 1812 came around, these bankers, these very bankers I'm talking about, who all also changed to away from the gold standard in England to fiat paper, also paid for and approved the burning down of the White House in Washington, D.C. in 1814. We're talking about these people. We're talking about extremely demonic people who have passed this knowledge and know-how of how to suck all the ideas out of other people, of human beings, and to make money from them. So we're talking about people that are habitually abusers. So we go through the 1800s, and we get to the time of Nikola Tesla's investment of wireless. The banks and the newspapers were already extremely familiar with how to use propaganda. And one of the things they recognized is they had to take control of communication, and they had to have it. And we've talked about that before, but we get to the telegraphy inventions and we see they made a quantum leap forward because they realized they could also use that same technology for sending messages for radio and then later for television. And so they started getting their act organized. So by the time of World War I, they were already actively and commercially using the Marconi wireless system that they had created through the British Empire all over the planet. And they gave the Marconi the monopoly on all of Tesla's inventions. So there we see a pooling of inventions prior to the time we're talking about. So by the end of World War I, the entire American Anglo-American alliance realized that telegraphy had to be controlled by a monopoly that would essentially be founded on the Marconi wireless system. So after World War I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was then Deputy Secretary of the Navy, ordered that all the American telecommunications companies, I'm talking about AT&T, Western Electric, Westinghouse, General Electric, and another one that sounds funny, but it's United Fruit Company, That's the company that owned all of the telephone and telegraph patents in South America. He ordered them to pool their patents together into what became Radio Corporation of America, RCA. And that was about 500 patents that were pooled into that group. And that became the basis for the American telecommunications system. So radio, television, and now internet. And that was a pool of patents. And one of the problems they were having with the technology, with the radio technology, is that they weren't able to commercialize the radio technology right away because they were having problems with noise. And the noise I'm talking about, an analogy would be you're talking on the phone and you're also talking on the internet, and there's a feedback because they aren't, those signals are not totally synced up. So you hear the echo that occurs, and then it can get squealy and it can hurt your ears. Well, they had a problem with that within the radio tubes of the time. And those tubes were vibrating, and the vibrations were causing noise and squeal, and it was a big problem. And they knew they could not commercialize radio until they fixed that problem. Well, a professor in the United States by the name of Hazeltine came up with something he called the Neutrodyne system that basically neutralized that noise and allowed radio to move forward. So radio moved forward in both the United States and Great Britain. And one of the things that occurred, and people didn't know this right away, but that Hazeltine cut a secret pooling deal with the British. Now, when I say the British, I'm talking about the proponents of the British Pilgrim Society, the people who were running the monarchy and who were running Parliament. The British Pilgrim Society, we've got their names. We have primary evidence that these were the people that cut the deal. And in doing that, Hazeltine allowed the British to have exclusive rights to the licenses for his technology for all radios worldwide. And that meant all the radios that were then subsequently manufactured in the United States were essentially under the control of this British patent pool. Now, when you're talking about 501 patents, including the Neutrodyne patent, you're talking about a great market power. And also you're forcing the licensees to license many technologies that they didn't even need because they had to license the whole pool at once. And that's the situation we had. And the engineer in the United States that was heavily pitching this Neutrodyne system, his name was Kimball Houghton Stark. And that we have documents he's written. We've got his picture, looks uncannily like Leonard P. Stark. And then we follow the Hazeltine Corporation's history, and we see that soon after Stark's father, Walter Stark, graduated from Michigan State University, he worked for the Department of Defense, and then he became the chief counsel for Hazeltine Corporation, which by then had major contracts with all of the U.S. military. Now, let's not skip that idea. He had major contracts with all of the U.S. military, and he was being run by the British patent pool, run by the British Pilgrim Society. I don't think you need to know any more than that to know that we were screwed as Americans. And then he moves forward. He's vice president. He's general counsel. He's the corporate secretary. And he's a director of Hazeltine. Well, in 1965, the Supreme Court upheld a ruling that Hazeltine was engaged in violations of the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act, which are basically antitrust laws. So this patent pool power was so egregious that they were ruled to have committed violations of the antitrust laws. So on paper, they were supposed to divest their licenses and allow other people in without forcing them to license the entire pool of of the British patents, Marconi primarily. And then we move forward from there and we see what they actually did was they just finessed how they handled those patent licenses going forward. And also they were tied at the hip with RCA. So Radio Corporation of America, which was is well known in congressional documents to have been driven and run by the British Pilgrim Society, and specifically
Capos.
No, the earlier David that ran RCA.
Sarnoff.
Sarnoff. David Sarnoff and the guy that was running RCA before him are all well-known pilgrims. So we have the pilgrims tied with RCA and also with Hazeltine. And so the RCA group had just basically subsumed all of these monopolistic relationships and moved them forward. And of course, Sarnoff and RCA created NBC. And then we see from the history, ABC and CBS followed along. They just followed NBC. And so there we see a monopoly in the wireless telecommunications area that exists to this day and has never really changed any of its mechanisms or its controls coming out of London. And then we see March 4th of 1946, we see our intelligence groups falling underneath the British MI6, MI5, and GCHQ using all this technology to control intelligence worldwide through what now we know is called the Five Eyes Agreement, where we gave up all American information and sovereignty to the British. So we're not making this up. The facts are what they are. And I have nothing against the British myself. I love the country. I have many friends in England and Britain and Scotland and Northern Ireland and Ireland. That's not the point here. What we see is an elitist group that has seized control of the British Isles hundreds of years ago. And since then has perfected that through their attorney banker culture. And what we see now is that the attorney banker culture is the underlying current that we are fighting here. We're talking about bankers who really don't care. They have no morals. They're financing both sides in wars. They figured out that wars were a great way to make money. They could then collapse economies and buy up with their fiat currency the assets of the losing the company or country in the war. And they've carried forward that system, and then they expanded that by creating companies themselves, which then became the corporate arm of this banking cabal, and that's what we're dealing with. So the people who came into that from our side are people like George Peabody, Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie. Those were all taking back seat to what was going on in London and have never not been in the back seat. Our bankers are all taking their directions from the Bank of England in London, who is protected by the monarch, who can't be sued, will lose every case if they try to protect themselves. And then we see all of these people, many of them are in the Privy Council, and they're allowed to create hundreds of companies like Lord Mark Malik Brown, who creates all these election systems to rig elections all over the planet. He then becomes Deputy Secretary of the UN. And isn't it magical how we now see the UN trying to exert their muscle now in the management of domain names? We saw that coming during Obama's era. So what we have seen, when you say the UN, you need to say British. You need to say British Pilgrim Society. That's who's running this. There is no question in my mind now. I don't know about yours, but no question in my mind. By the way, that's not a cue of reflection in my. That's a round light.
we have the proof of it. And, you know, these people, these corporate merchant warriors, corporate merchant pirates, I mean, some of them literally take a pirate saber and put it on their symbol. You know, I mean, they are out there for the worst form of capitalism that there is. And in fact, they know that these patents create the greatest amount of money. And notice, as Michael has just pointed out, that all the names there in relationship to patents are all going to be lawyers, and all the names in relationship to banks are all going to be lawyers. And the creation of our central bank system here in America, the U.S. Federal Reserve, those were all the lawyers of the big bankers. Right. I mean, when it comes down to it, it's the same old people, and there is no way that you can possibly imagine how evil they are or how they think. Let me give you one tiny example, which is in your article, and that's that FDR, if you'd please tell us about that, and then also tell us about what's the advantage for the evil ones, for these demons, these devils, as you called them in your article, and you're quite right to say so, these worshippers of Mammon. What is the reason for them to have these patent pools? I assume it's so that their lawyers can undo okay. the cases. But also, tell them about the 50,000 patents that were part of the motivation for the World War. The World right. Wars were actually the British lusting after the patents of the Germans.
Correct. Yeah, that we learned, we found that early on, and we didn't know how that fit into this, but we do now. And before I talk about FDR, let me mention why patent pools are necessary to a monopolist. Now, that you have to realize, they're necessary to a monopolist because the only way in telecommunications, there's a lot of bits and pieces and parts for to make a telephone work or a radio work. And so there's multiple inventions. So you had some intrepid inventor out there fixing a particular technology problem and filed a patent and got a patent for a piece of what these monopolists want to have in order to manage and control all communication. So in the case of after World War I, that was about 50 or 500 patents. But as you move forward, then in order to continue to maintain your monopoly and keep other people out of the business, the challenge is how do you keep grabbing the new inventions and making sure they come within your orbit. And that's what the patent pooling does. It gives them a guaranteed lock on all the invention required to make these very complex systems work. And so from monopolist viewpoint, it's very natural. I got to have a monopoly. I mean, let me tell you, Chandler told me one time, he said, Mike, this is almost a quote, Mike, Sometimes an invention is just way too good for the guy who invented it. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't get the context. And now I know he was advocating that IBM steal it because I couldn't possibly build a company to exploit it. That's the general argument that entrepreneurs get thrown at them all the time by these scumbag venture capitalists. You don't possibly have the talent to build a company to exploit this. So we have to come in as the benevolent financier and knowledgeable business people to make this work. Really, you can't do it.
But Mike, the thing is in the very beginning, you said that Facebook had encroached upon the social media landscape because of this, but it's more than Facebook. It's everyone out there. Twitter, even Gab is using your technology. Has Andrew Torba acknowledged that he is using a stolen technology to run Gab?
Not to my knowledge. He hasn't called me.
No, he needs to call you and set this right, because this is where we like to post on Gab. And it bothers me each time I do that we are doing that upon the theft of social media by IBM Eclipse Foundation. And of course, what they did is they took it and then they dispersed it for free for everyone. Well, that was just to hide their original theft of your technology. And right. One other thing before you go on, you said that General Freeze was on your board, but it's not like you picked him. How did he come to get on your board? Because I think about that Theronis, and Elizabeth Holmes is her name. She had a board with Henry Kissinger on it and all these big time people. Anytime you see a board like that, you have to wonder, why are they on the board and what are they looking for so that they will steal it?
Right. Well, the answer is simple to a freeze. I was looking for introductions to patent attorneys in Washington, and several business people here in town had some experience working in Washington, and I was introduced to several people who knew Freeze. And so, as far as I know, I wasn't targeted at that point, but Douglas, you think I was. One way or another, I met him, and given his background having run the NSA, essentially, I thought he would be a useful person to be a director. So I asked him to come on. And of course, at that time, I was naive enough to think all generals were honorable. Don't think that now. But so that was how Freeze got on our board. And it was Freeze who recommended that I meet Chandler. Well, now we know, going back through their history, that Freeze and Chandler were tied at the hip at building this U.S.-controlled British entourage. What's the right word? The British outpost for everything to do with surveillance and communication technology. They were together. Chandler was giving them legal advice on how to pull this off. But we have to remember that Freeze in 1978 was the general, he was a brigadier general then, who authorized Project Echelon, which was the beginning of the surveillance of Americans on U.S. soil. So he was a bad guy. I admit that as an entrepreneur, I don't know how it could have been more discriminating, but obviously I picked the wrong guy.
Or he picked you. And that's, as you said, that is my opinion, because I believe that you were watched all along from the time you were at AT&T solving those problems, because those are the very problems that DARPA puts out as their questions that they need answers to.
Right.
And DARPA and through the Highlands Forum, Highlands Group, and InQtel, particularly for all the digital problems, they literally sit around and do nothing but try to find anybody who has an invention that they can then steal and subsume through these patent pools. And of course, these patent pools are absolutely the worst thing possible. So if we have a judge at the circuit level handling all patent claims, which right now, most of the patent claims are for the poor person who invented it, someone comes in with a lawyer and claims that they infringed upon their patent. This is what Hillary Clinton did. She was a patent infringement lawyer.
Right.
Because there is so much huge money in that. You don't have to have invented anything.
Well, you just put your shingle out there and all the patentees come in and they naively trust that these attorneys are not going to violate their attorney-client privilege, which is a total fake. I mean, I assume there are some honorable ones, but I haven't met many. And at some point, even the honorable ones don't do us the service that they should, because they know the games that are being played behind the scenes. And if they don't warn the entrepreneur, then they're a part of the problem, even if they don't do it themselves. So I don't have a very good view of patent attorneys right now. Is that obvious?
Well, the whole attorney thing is very British also. I mean, what is it? It's an inner club that goes to the bar that is recognized by the bar to have standing to be able to speak. In other words, you know, common law, where the common person might have standing to exist, doesn't exist in the higher forms of law. I can't just go before a court and have standing to sue for something that I don't like that the federal government did. I have to, as a matter of fact, and look what's behind all their names, Esquire. Esquire means it's a title. Well, that is unconstitutional to be able to have a title, especially when that goes right back to Britain and the British Bar Association, which is connected to the American Bar Association. So, and then the Queen's Court. The Queen's Court, the King's Court. So if you have a problem with the Bank of England or the Queen or the Privy Council or anyone who represents the Privy Council or the Queen, tough luck. It's going to go to a court where the decision has already been decided in favor of the monarch. Why?
Right.
Because the monarch is literally a pope of their own religion, the Anglican religion, and they basically are as infallible, supposedly, as the pope is himself. And this is the kind of insanity to think that one human is higher than another, whether it be through a monarchical system, aristocracy, assumed lordships. Like, look at what we talked about last time with the court Jews of the Bauer family, who became the Rothschilds, who then were given literally aristocratic titles. Well, what is that? That is money being able to buy anything. And right. That's what we're talking about here. Money to buy anything.
Yeah, let me, on the other side of that, you're an entrepreneur, you come up with an invention, and you're recommended to go to law. And as it turns out, a patent from A to Z is all about the law. So you go to an attorney that you assume you can trust. And then you also assume you can trust the legal system that that runs the patent law to be fair to the inventor. Well, let's go back to the patenting. When you file a patent, they've got a bunch of rules that you have to describe your patent completely. You can't leave anything out. If you leave something out, you can have your patent undone. And so you describe it in very great detail, and then you have to hand that description to the patent office. And the patent office has these patent examiners. You don't know these are people from Adam. And you're supposed to trust that this entire patent system in Washington is going to preserve your secrets while you're in the patenting process. Now, that's the height of naivete. Now I can see that. But then I trusted that was the case. So you put your idea out there. Now we know, certainly since 2006, that all of those patent applications are shipped to England through a company that has the sole contract to manage and to examine all the patent applications that come through the U.S. Patent Office. Now, that just sounds so stupid. Why would we do that? But we do it. And now we know what the point is. These attorney bankers realized that patents were their future value. So what they have done is, through the attorney side of their mentality, they have figured out very clever ways to basically push a confidence trick upon entrepreneurs to put their ideas out there with the idea that you're going to benefit the public. But in fact, what I see now, all I'm going to do is benefit this patent pooling system that is going to grab that idea and is not going to wait for your patent to be issued. They're going to go ahead and start exploiting it secretly. You're never going to find out about that for years, as we're still learning things about what Facebook did. But you're never going to find out about that for years. In the meantime, they can make the lion's share of the cash off the value of that idea before you're even aware of the infringement. And they do that over and over again. And as you introduced us 2 years ago, it's worse because we've got this Office of Net Assessment within the Department of Defense that's run by DARPA and a group of public-private companies that get to meet privately and get all those patent applications and decide which ones of those are going to be weaponized and commercialized by this group of insiders. That's the definition of fascism, and that is what has driven our patent system, not only for the history of the Republic, but probably prior to that.
And it's important to remember that Hyland's group, or the Office of Net Assessment, or DARPA and QTEL, those are all attended by multinational corporations and venture capitalists, multinational venture capitalists. Those are not the American Department of Defense. And when it comes down to it, of course, the British are always represented there. But when it comes down to it, you might ask, well, wait a second, what are the British doing involved in our U.S. Patent Office? Why would they have first dibs on any patent? That's called industrial espionage. It's not even the British, it's Serco. And what is Serco? Serco came out of the cabal, a syndicate, a patent pool for the complete control of propaganda through all media, which was RCA and then GE and then Serco. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how in the world it came that a corporate group of the people I call the corporate merchant warriors or corporate merchant pirates came to be in control of our God-given most wonderful grace, which is our willpower, our ability to do things, to love, really, because love is an act of will. How is it that our willpower, which is put into our patents, came into the hands of the most corrupt industrial espionage institutionalization that we've ever seen in history?
You're asking about the invention of Serco. And Serco is a British company. In the end, it's controlled by something called the Monarch's Golden Share, which means the monarch has 100% control of the company. Serco is today managing these detention centers in Australia. They handle train systems. They handle pathology labs. This is one of the corporations that the British are trying to use to take over the world. And it didn't start like that. They started by the middle of in the 70s. The British universities were getting quite a bit of money to handle a lot of these electronic and biotech inventions. And they were working to attempt to figure out how they were going to unify all of that inventing into one place and still take care of their entrepreneurs, take care of their inventors. So there was a man, and the organization that funded a lot of these universities was called CERC, S-E-R-C. And it was run by a British knight by the name of Sir Geoffrey Paddy. And here, everything I'm telling you, we have hard evidence of. And then by the late 70s, they decided that they were going to take CERC out of a nonprofit educational realm, R&D realm, and move it into commercial operation. And so in 1978, Geoffrey Paddy formed CERC Co., which is CERC Company. And in the process, he allowed the just lost my train of thought again.
Well, let me just, I want to put this to give everyone a big view, because there's so many moving parts. When you really step up over 10,000 feet, what you see is the British Imperial Empire never went away. The sun never set on it. And they're always out stealing resources of countries and people. In the early days, it may have been spices and rubber, and then it went into resources, right, nickel and gold and silver and all of that. And when they had done that, then we moved into stealing resources of the human being, which is slavery. And we've done a lot of work on that to show that the slavery trade is still going on. And you've got to look at the YMCA and Salvation Army to look at this hideous practice that's still going on by the British Imperial Empire, which we also call the Pilgrim Society. And then we looked at another level of slavery, again, by the British, which is debt slavery. And this is where you roll it back to the bankers. And now what you're describing is the theft and the taking the resources of the human creativity and imagination, something in between your ears, and stealing that and making money off of it. So they've just stolen everything, the British, not right, the English people, the British have stolen everything. And it just pisses me off to hear Donald Trump up there with that Nigel Farage giving kudos to the Queen and what a lovely lady she is. And that squirrely Prince Charles, oh, he's a fine guy. And yes, get my Truth Social network that he's starting, raising billions of dollars as a grifter. And has he called you? Has he asked permission? Has he said he's going to pay Leader Technologies for parking his platform on your technology? No, he hasn't. Now, when you look at the vaccination program, this genocide program, the problem is they've run out of time. They kicked the can down the road, and they have got to kill us all because they are going to be found out.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts in this story, but now we're seeing the common threads. And it's the attorney bankers who have layered our legal systems with all of these levels of demonic activity, to the point where me as an entrepreneur was trying to follow those laws. And the point I was trying to make was all of those laws were designed not to protect me, but to fake that they were protecting me while they were in fact feeding this patent pooling system. And so we go back to the story on Serco and Sir Geoffrey Paddy. What they started doing was forming Serco, and here's a telltale sign of that what we're saying is exactly right. Paddy actually used the charter of RCA Limited to start Serco. So obviously it was nothing more than a Serco or RCA clone, which included Hazeltine, which included this monopoly of the Hazeltine patents, and therefore the British control of American, not only technology, but then we get into the 90s and we discover that Sir Geoffrey Paddy became the trustee on a reorganized British Intellectual Property Institute, where he not only put a bunch of sirs and lords and dukes in charge of their intellectual property, but he added a bunch of commercial corporations like Microsoft, Oracle, Apple, and others, along with DLA Piper, who is now in control of Kamala Harris. So it's obvious that the British have always had their designs on American technology. And when we came along, one of the things that I did is by the mid-90s, I had banged my head against the wall and recognized that people like AT&T and others were just stealing everything I told them. And so what I specifically did, and this was out of sequence, because normally entrepreneurs will go to venture capitalists, they'll tell the venture capitalists their ideas, and then the venture capitalists start behind the scenes figuring out how they're going to carve up the elephant and making sure that the entrepreneur may get enough to live on and enough to be happy with what they've done, but they're never going to get the lion's share of the value. That's going to go to these VC attorney bankers. And so what I specifically did not do is I did not tell any of these VCs what we were doing in those early days until we had it all invented. And that was out of sequence with how they normally suck all the ideas out while they're still in the germination stage. And that part worked. We came out at the end of 2000, beginning of 2000, and everybody was no doubt shocked, because what we can now see is they were all scrambling to rethink how they were going to take control of the internet based on this new invention of leader technologies. And so they put Zuckerberg at Facebook in 2001. We found some additional issues with scalability that we worked on for two more years. So they put him on hold and made him stall everyone else. And then when we came out, within months of us debugging the key tracking module, Zuckerberg was up and running, as well as everyone else in the social world, because we now know IBM immediately fanned out our technology to everybody in the business.
Well, what we can see here is that the British, again, are the culprits. They are the usual suspects. And as Betsy had pointed out, it's the stealing of the willpower, the sacred willpower that they used in the worst fashion, which was slavery. And now what we've heard today is that, again, leader technology theft goes right back to the key point, which is a type of enslavement, an enslavement right. of the inventors of America.
Exactly.
Enslavement of entrepreneurs. And it continues to be the same thing, all a type of worship of mammon.
Yes, that's a good point. When we talk about slavery, we're programmed to think of black and brown slavery from plantations. That's what we're programmed to do. But the fact is, that hasn't been the case for a long time. What has been the case since that time is these guys figured out a more clever way of starting debt slavery and therefore enslaving everyone, white, black, brown, red, yellow. So we're all slaves, and we just don't choose to think of ourselves like slaves, so we don't think we're a part of that deal. But the fact is, I can now see that everything about an inventor trying to take a good idea to market is hemmed in on every level by the financiers, the banker attorneys, who are looking for how to suck all your ideas out while giving you peanuts. That's what they want. And they figured out how to do it. And they get a lot of us to go along with it.
And once again, Mike and the miners and the staff writers at Americans for Innovation have brought that forward so that we can raise our heads up from plowing the field and look at our puppet masters and basically begin to stand up for ourselves and take back what is ours, which is our own sacred willpower. So thanks, Mike, for the show today. And thank you, Tyler, Betsy, for also helping us today take a look at this big question.